Al Jazeera Podcasts.
Today, Gaza gets a ceasefire, or at least a UN Security Council resolution for one.
There can be impact on the ground now, but it requires the warring parties, first of all, to listen. And then if that doesn't happen, it requires the Security Council to act again.
The story of how it happened and why it took months. I'm Malika Bilal, and this is The Take.
My name is Anade Situma. I am the senior UN producer for Al Jazeera English, based at UN headquarters here in New York City.
Anade, welcome to The Take. It is so good to have you here, and on what's a momentous occasion for the UN.
Thank you, Malika. I'm very excited to talk to you.
So, Anade, you have been covering the UN Security Council's attempts to call for a ceasefire in Gaza for months.
The U.S. has vetoed three previous resolutions demanding a halt to the fighting. And just a few days ago had presented its own resolution to the Security Council. But the U.S. resolution failed after Russia and China vetoed it.
Several resolutions have been put forward in the past, but haven't passed. And that finally changed on Monday.
The draft resolution has been adopted
when the Security Council demanded an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas and the release of all captives.
The text says that the fighting should stop for the month of Ramadan.
It also calls for the unconditional release of captives and unrestricted access to desperately needed aid.
What was it like in that room when the resolution passed?
So I watched the Security Council chamber every single day, and I think what was interesting about the day the resolution passed is there were so many huddles. You'll see the footage. There were big huddles as well, right? You'd see like a huddle of maybe 20 diplomats. And in the center, the biggest one, we saw the ambassador for Russia to the UN, the ambassador from Palestine to the UN. You'd see the British ambassador pop in, the Maltese ambassador pop in. Typically what happens with resolutions is they do this process where they go into blue, which gives all the Security Council members 24 hours informally to go back to their capitals, figure out their country's position, decide their remarks, and then typically they enter the chamber already knowing exactly where they stand. But with the Gaza resolution vote, the ceasefire vote, that was completely different. We had heard that they were trying to change the wording up until the moment people took their seats.
Wow.
We had heard that the US was possibly going to put forward an amendment. Then that changed on the floor. Al Jazeera has an office right above, a floor above the Security Council chamber. And so we get the direct feed from the UN. And so I'm watching it, but I also am texting people who are in the room. And so I was told this amendment was going to happen. Then Russia said that they were going to make an amendment. Then everyone's kind of trying to figure out if the Russian amendment is going to lead to a U.S. veto, if the U.S. veto is going to lead to a Russian veto. And so it was strange because the fact that we had gotten this far meant that there was a lot of hope that the resolution would pass. But the meeting itself was delayed 20 minutes with these huddles and these talks and these negotiations.
Wow.
Yeah, it was kind of dramatic. Huh. And we saw, it was very interesting, we'd seen the word in the resolution, and I have it here. Initially, it said that all parties, it demands an immediate ceasefire for the month of Ramadan, respected by all parties, leading to a permanent, sustainable ceasefire.
Permanent being the key word.
On the day, permanent became durable, then durable became lasting, and lasting is what we voted on.
That is incredibly interesting to learn that so much of it comes down to what could arguably be semantics. But of course, the impact on the ground is so much larger than semantics, permanent versus lasting.
Yes.
So let's talk about what was different and why this one actually passed, because we know the U.S. vetoed three previous drafts. We know that last Friday, China and Russia vetoed another draft put forward by the U.S. And this time around, the U.S. abstained.
The U.S. deciding to abstain, according to the White House, letting that resolution pass instead of vetoing it.
So what was different about this that made it pass?
I think the best way to look at it is to start with the veto that China and Russia used on Friday when that resolution was going. So what was interesting about the Chinese and the Russian perspective is they feel like the demand for an immediate ceasefire should be decoupled, almost delinked for the demand for the immediate release of captives, right? And so they don't think that the release of the captives is what's necessary for a ceasefire to happen, which is what you see and you hear a lot on the negotiations on the ground. And so for China and Russia, it needed to be decoupled. But right, like you're saying with semantics, the way in which that happened is that they then said in the resolution, and also demands the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages. Hmm. And also does not mean they have to happen at the same time.
Wow.
Right? Hmm. And so that was what changed it from the Russian-Chinese perspective. What changed it from the American perspective, and this is very interesting, is if you look back at council records, there was actually a very, very similar resolution that was put forward in December that the Americans vetoed. But what we know and what we've seen and you've been reporting on as well is the context is changing for America.
Russia and China vetoed a U.S. draft resolution that called for a ceasefire but didn't specifically demand one, instead saying the ceasefire was simply imperative. Language like that, Russia argued, would not hold Israel accountable.
I wish to draw attention to the following. The U.S. draft contains an effective green light for Israel to mount a military operation in Rafah.
There's this looming Rafah assault that has made the urgency visceral, right? Even the U.S. feels that Rafah is a red line, which is something that's a little bit different. And so I do think the timing of the resolution influenced it heavily. And I also think that the wording was done in a way that made it digestible for the elected members, for Russia and for China and for the U.S.
So the U.S. abstention, some see as essentially a vote for yes, but they couldn't do that on the record or didn't want to do that on the record. Were you all surprised when they abstained, virtually allowing this to go forward? Or was that determined in those pre-huddles?
So we'd heard the U.S. was possibly going to abstain, mainly because a lot of Security Council members don't want to put something to the vote if it's going to fail. Mm. It just looks bad, to be very honest with you. There's no consensus. There's no single voice. And so very rarely would you see something go to the vote with such confidence if they didn't think it was going to pass.
The U.S. abstention might not have been a surprise, but for some, Israel's reaction to that abstention was.
Now, this has inflamed an already tense relationship between Israel and the U.S. After the vote, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu cancelled a trip to Washington by an Israeli delegation of top officials.
Al Jazeera's White House correspondent, Kimberly Halkett, was watching that reaction as it unfolded.
The White House seemed to be kind of perplexed by what happened after the vote. And the reason is that my understanding from my sources is that the White House had consulted extensively in the days leading up to Monday's vote with Israel and had indicated that the United States was likely to abstain from that vote. So what happened afterward, namely that Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, not only threatened but then canceled a high-level delegation in terms of its visit to Washington, was really something that caught the White House off guard. The visit by that delegation was meant to review Israel's military campaign into Rafah. The White House had been hoping to influence that decision in terms of that campaign, perhaps look at alternatives. And the reason for that is that the Biden administration believes that it's a mistake, that there would be a high cost to civilian lives, but also that it would be a mistake for Israel's standing globally. Benjamin Netanyahu issued a statement accusing the White House of a shift in policy when it comes to its support of Israel. And this is something that the White House has flatly denied, saying there has been no shift in policy. And we really saw the White House, through the National Security Council spokesperson, John Kirby, trying to downplay what has become this public chasm.
Our vote does not, I repeat, does not represent a shift in our policy. We've been very clear, we've been very consistent in our support for a ceasefire as part of a hostage deal.
The White House was sort of falling over itself, trying to underscore that the United States will always have Israel's back, even as there was this harsh accusation of just the opposite coming from Benjamin Netanyahu.
So how did the rest of the world react? That's after the break.
Welcome to Necessary Tomorrows. My name is Ursula. I am an AI, and I have inferred from your online activity that you have been feeling more dread than hope when you think about the future that is coming for us here in the 2060s. So I have created a course just for you to enhance your capacity for imagining different futures. Necessary Tomorrows, an audio series by Doha Debates and Al Jazeera. Find it where you listen to podcasts.
A quick reminder before we get back to our show. If you're listening to The Take on Google Podcasts, starting April 2nd, the app will no longer be available. So find us on YouTube Music, Spotify, CastBox, or any other podcast platform. So the UN Security Council ceasefire resolution was met with reactions around the world.
We look forward to the commitment of the Israeli occupier to this decision and to stop killing immediately.
The United Kingdom has long been calling for an immediate humanitarian pause leading to a sustainable ceasefire.
Over 32,000 innocent civilians have lost their lives. For the lives that have already perished, the Council resolution today comes too late.
Anade, I know that you've been following them. And the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. was one of those reactors. Linda Thomas-Greenfield called it a non-binding resolution.
We did not agree with everything in the resolution. For that reason, we were unfortunately not able to vote yes. However, as I've said before, we fully support some of the critical objectives in this non-binding resolution.
You were at the Security Council stakeout, where Mozambique's ambassador spoke on behalf of the elected 10 group, and you asked a question on whether this ceasefire resolution is binding.
Ambassador of the United States, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, mentioned that this is a non-binding resolution. What is your reaction to those comments?
It was a mixed bag.
Under the Charter, all Security Council resolutions are binding.
I think, you know, in their defense, I think the moment that sums it up the best was the Palestinian ambassador came on afterwards to respond to the same question.
Those who say that the Security Council is not enforceable or not mandatory, give us a break. We go to the General Assembly, they say it is not enforced or binding. We come to the Security Council, they tell us it's not binding. We do not buy that.
It was a momentous occasion, but it was like the thunder was stolen in that one sentence, right? Because it's particularly difficult when the one council member with the most influence on the warring party says it's not legally binding. Almost every expert on the Security Council, on the laws of Security Council, international human rights laws, the spokesperson for the United Nations have all said that any United Nations Security Council resolution is legally binding because inherently it becomes international law. And it sent ripples through the diplomatic community and the diplomatic world, because if that's not legally binding, what else is not legally binding is the question, right? And so it's a very, very important sentence. And there's a reason we're all looking at it, because the consequences are one for Israel and Palestine and the war that's happening in Gaza, but also for any other resolution that comes behind it.
So are there going to be UN consequences if Israel doesn't comply?
So this is all eyes on the Security Council. So the Security Council will issue a resolution like the one that we saw that demands an immediate ceasefire. And then it is up to the Security Council to implement their resolutions. And so the next thing would be a stronger resolution where they can say, because of non-compliance, we're going to sanction particular parties. Or because of non-compliance, we're going to sanction particular use of force, right? So the Security Council must now, if the warring parties do not listen to the Security Council resolution, make another stronger resolution on implementation.
The threat of action from the Security Council isn't the only thing that could cause Israel to change course. There's also their relationship with the U.S., which supplies Israel with more than $3 billion in military aid a year. Here's Kimberly Halkett again.
The U.S. opposes any move by Israel to go into Rafah And if Netanyahu defies Joe Biden and does it anyway, this could really be the final straw for the United States. It would collapse trust between Israel and the United States. And you also have to remember the political considerations of the White House right now. Joe Biden is looking for a second term in the Oval Office. He's running for re-election in November, and he's under a lot of pressure from the global community, but also domestically, even from members of his own Democratic Party, to really rein in Israel's response to the October 7th attacks on Israel by Hamas. And so the vice president has made it clear. She has said that if Israel goes into Rafah, the White House sees that as a huge mistake and asked if she would rule out consequences if Israel defies the White House and its counsel and guidance. Well, she's been very clear.
I am ruling out nothing.
And so I think that shows you where things stand.
So, Anade, do you think that this resolution will have an impact on the situation in Gaza? And is that a conversation that's happening in the halls of the UN today?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it's a conversation that's happening because I think that's the point. I think particularly in the halls of the UN, there's just so much loss, right? There's so much loss of life. I think we're filled in a building of humanitarians and they're very conscious of that. When you talk about sanitation and access to water, there's a consequence that is health, that is loss of life, right? Like, I think everyone's very viscerally aware of the need for an impact on the ground. And so I think that's why it has meaning, because this is the first step to get any kind of implementation. And so I do think that's why people even in Gaza are watching what the Security Council does. Because if this resolution didn't pass, how could there be any impact on the ground, right? Like, what is the alternative? A gaping hole in international diplomacy where there's definitely not going to be impact on the ground. Diplomacy is difficult, and diplomacy is always going to be extremely difficult when the war is ongoing. Mm-hmm. But I do think that this ceasefire resolution, for one, started to reflect a lot of the protests we see on the ground. Right. And it's interesting to see the Security Council start to reflect public sentiment. And that, I think, is extremely important when it comes to the United Nations, because it is supposed to be our United Nations as the citizens of the world. Right. Like, it doesn't belong to these diplomats. It belongs to us. That's the theory.
And that's The Take. This episode was produced by Sadie El-Khalili and David Enders, with Chloe K. Lee, Varanisa Kampana, Miranda Lin, Amy Walters, Nagin Oliayi, Sonia Bagat, Ashish Malhotra, Khalid Sultan, Zainab Badr, and me, Malika Bilal. Alex Roldan is our sound designer. Joe Plord mixed this episode. Alexandra Locke is The Take's executive producer, and Nay Alvarez is Al Jazeera's head of audio. We'll be back tomorrow.